This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Hello and welcome to Heritage Matters, a program brought to you by the Southern Heritage Trust and sponsored by Heritage New Zealand. I'm Dougal Stevenson. In this program, Gregor Campbell looks at the mysterious case of an assault that never was. Bill Southworth reviews a book on the woman who established Queenstown's Eichardt's Hotel. An unsung mine disaster hero is remembered, and Alison Breeze tells us how Oamaru fits into the National Historic Landmarks program. To be or not to be. That was at the centre of the great liquor prohibition debate in New Zealand at the end of the First World War. People were arguing over whether to bring it in or not. One teetotaler who was organising the sober voters in Roxburgh appeared to have been roughed up for his troubles. This report from Gregor Campbell.
It is legendary that the whole of New Zealand nearly went dry at the end of the First World War. Votes for prohibition were looking good until the ballots came back from our troops in Europe. Soldiers wanted a beer when they came home from the war. Passions were high on both sides, and the New Zealand Truth weighed in on behalf of the drinking classes and against those they described as wowsers. So, in early 1919, when a prohibition lecturer got himself in a little trouble, the Truth reported it with more than a little gusto. On Monday of last week, people all over New Zealand recoiled in horror before the telegraphed news that a prohibition lecturer had been set upon and stabbed in Roxburgh. Their indignation and their abhorrence were fed by the circumstantial account of the occurrence, telegraphed and circulated throughout the country next day. This widely published story was headed, "Dastardly Assault, Alliance Agent at Roxburgh Badly Handled." And it went on to say that Mr. J.A. McCartney, agent for the New Zealand Alliance for the Otago Electorate, stationed at Roxburgh, was the victim of a dastardly assault last Saturday evening, about 8:45 p.m. While out enjoying a stroll, he was suddenly attacked by two men and badly knocked about, being left on the road unconscious. After regaining consciousness, he managed to reach his lodgings, where medical aid had to be summoned. The young man, who was a student for the ministry, was suffering from severe shock, and on examination, it was further discovered that a knife had been used on him, as his arm bore three wounds, with another smaller wound on the chest. The assailants are at present unknown, but investigations are proceeding. Roxburgh has an unenviable reputation of late, and the citizens, who value its good name, are much put out by this recent happening. A meeting of several residents took place on Monday evening, and a resolution was carried and forwarded to the Minister of Justice, demanding increased police protection. When this news was flashed across the wires, signs of apprehension and indignation at once began to make themselves manifest. The Dunedin police, with a promptitude that did them credit, landed per motor car at the scene of the happening within 48 hours of its birth. No assailant could possibly escape from sleuths so quickly on the spot. Detectives know that men who run about the country stabbing people on Saturdays always observe the Sabbath rest. That, possibly, is why the demons waited until Monday before leaving for Roxburgh. Then came Thursday. With it came the detectives home again. With them came an emaciated, googly-eyed youth. The city went mad at the sight. The cowardly assailant, he who with murder in his heart and a knife in his hand had waylaid a divinity student and had struck to the earth a prohibition lecturer, was at last being brought to justice. But the people's joy was short-lived. It soon got hinted abroad that the companion of the detectives was not the attacker, but the attacked. Left to his own resources, Truth's representative began investigations on his own account. And this is the story he has to tell. Jack McCartney, born in England, has a wife and one child. During the last couple of years, he's been employed by Lane & Co, aerated water manufacturers of Dunedin. The principals of Lane & Co gave him a character of the first magnitude. Indeed, it is said of him that few men could be so depended upon when it came to the getting away of rush orders. Once, when in the employ of Lane & Co, a raw-boned youth knocked him down. McCartney had a fit as the result. He earned £3 a week at Lane's, 2 and 6 over the union wage. A few weeks ago he left, giving his boss to understand that he was going to work at a store in the country. It was stated that he took up a job as representative of the New Zealand Alliance at Roxburgh at the princely remuneration of £3.5 a week. The result was a severe mental strain and, as a natural consequence, McCartney had a fit. Hallucinations possessed him. He thought he was being attacked by strangers, two of them. There, apparently, McCartney's connection with the affair ends. Here was a golden opportunity to show the world what miscreants, what diabolical agents of everything that was loathsome were those who opposed prohibition. They rushed at once to the telephones and to the telegraph station and sent out the messages, of which the one at the beginning of this story is a sample. In their feverish haste to get one back on those who are not in agreement with them on the liquor question, they threw discretion to the winds and put into circulation a sensation which has made Dunedin laugh itself into a delirium. Even if McCartney had really been waylaid and stabbed, the cruelty and audacity with which the apostles of Wowserism made capital out of the canard could not possibly have been equaled. What an awakening they will have when these, the facts of the dastardly outrage, are given to the public. Just one word by way of conclusion. McCartney does not drink. He is a walking example of efficiency. That is, when he's not in a fit. And I am that non-alligator, Gregor Campbell, for Heritage Matters.
The luxury Eichardt's Hotel on Queenstown's lakefront was set up by Julia Eichardt and her husband Albert in the 19th century. Her life has now become the inspiration for an historical novel by a retired Central Otago GP, and it's reached the top of the country's bestseller fiction list. This report from Bill Southworth.
When Julia Eichardt came to Queenstown in 1862, it was a rough and ready place, mainly put together with canvas and sticks, and its streets were bogs of mud and horse manure. But Julia had a dream. As a little Irish immigrant, she had once seen a grand and beautifully dressed woman in a Melbourne street and had fantasised about being like that woman one day. How she made that dream come true is the basis for an historical novel by retired GP Lauren Roche called Julia Eichardt, A Life of Grit and Grace, from Tipperary to Central Otago. Working from slender resources such as the Hocken Library and Papers Past, which gave her the bare bones of Julia's history, Lauren Roche constructed her novel and was more than happy to bring at least one pioneer woman of Queenstown to her readers' attention. Julia's Eichardt Hotel, which she established with her husband Albert, now stands grandly on Queenstown's waterfront. I spoke by phone with Lauren at her Central Otago home. I asked her why Julia had left her home in Melbourne in her early 20s and travelled to little and remote Queenstown.
She needed to get away from her mum in order to start her own life. So she followed her brother Sylvester, who came to New Zealand during the Otago gold rush. Julia came over a year or so after Sylvester did, ostensibly to look after him, but I think mostly to start her own life and her own hotel.
That was pretty revolutionary, wasn't it? Because at that time, around about 1862, Queenstown was a pretty rough little town, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was canvas and sticks and an awful lot of mud. William Gilbert Rees had a run all around Lake Wakatipu. Then gold was found and the miners came in. And the town kind of blossomed, but it was still canvas and sticks when she got there. The hotel where she was initially employed was called the Queen's Arms Hotel. and that was a repurposed sheep shearing shed of William Reeser. All of the town high men who turned up for meetings had to wear their hats inside, which was really not terribly good protocol, because when it rained, the water thundered through the roof.
At that time, there was a gold rush on in places like the Shotover and Arrowtown and other places.
All these little places shot up, and I think the worry was with Queenstown that once the gold had moved on, the town would disappear. And people like William Rees and Albert Eichardt, Bendix Hallenstein, some of the elder men of the town decided they needed to look somewhere else. And with Julia, they decided they'd look to tourism as a way of keeping the town alive.
Could you tell us what the life of a gold miner was like at that time?
The life of a gold miner at that time was really perilous. These guys were going out up ravines and into hills where there were no shops. There were no trees. The tiger had a lot of shrubs, but not a lot of trees. There were no birds they could catch apart from the weka. There were no trout. There were eels. There were no fresh vegetables. And anything that came up was likely rotten before it arrived. In the early hours of every morning, there'd be up to 200 men standing outside Bracken's Queen's Arms, waiting for Reeves to bring his whaling boat across the lake. Many of the men were so hungry that they would eat flour as it was put into their pannikins. They'd mix it with a bit of water and eat it. And there are lots of stories about seeing these starving men walking with white marks on their mouths.
And when they weren't eating flour, of course, it was mutton, mutton, and more mutton.
And more and more and more mutton. They got rather sick of mutton, I hear.
They also had to worry about bushrangers taking their gold as well, didn't they?
There was a lot of trouble with bushrangers. Hugh Bracken, who was the original proprietor of Queen's Arms, had done a very famous arrest of some bushrangers. So he was revered by the miners. Initially, the Otago Regional Council tried to suppress the news of the gold because Otago was supposed to be this morally superior, really good Christian province, and they didn't want the lawlessness that had happened in California and Victoria. So they were very well policed very quickly.
I noticed in your novel you managed to include quite well-known people of that area like Bendix Hallenstein, who was the founder of the clothing factories and stores.
Yes, and he was also a good friend of Albert Eichardt. When we released the book at Eichardt's hotel last week, some of Bendix Hallenstein's descendants were there, and they told me the story about Bendix falling off his horse one day. He used to take his horse all the time from Speargrass Flats through to Eichardt's hotel. He and Albert would sit in the front window and drink coffee with schnapps. And one day Bendix must have been perhaps a little under the weather, and he fell off his horse. And limped ever after.
The Albert Eichardt you refer to was a retired Prussian military officer who Julia eventually married, isn't that so?
Managed to buy Eichardt's hotel when he won a large gold nugget in a raffle.
So that was the beginning of the hotel itself. I mean, it eventually became a very grand hotel built of stone right on the lake shore there. But I assume initially it was a much more modest place.
It was. Initially, it was canvas and sticks, then it was a wooden building, then in 1871, they built a stone wing on the building, 1872, they did the other end of the building, but the middle was still made out of wood. After the death of Albert in 1882, Julia got the middle part made in stone too, so that the building was a whole. It was this beautiful, misty Italian stone, and it was the hotel of her dreams.
Indeed, she began living her dream of being a grand lady running a great hotel.
She did. She was in a powerful position as a widow. So as a widow, she was able to have control of her money and her estate. And we look at the wills of Albert, Julia, she managed to increase that holding really significantly after her husband's death.
She herself died, at the age of 54, after falling and getting severe concussion.
She did, yeah. They'd been having, the never-ending renovations of the hotel, and a builder had left a piece of wood just by the back step. She went to step out, tripped, and smacked it on one of the stone windowsills. It took her about 10 days to die, and she died in the hotel that she loved. Some of the really nice stories came out afterwards were that all of the businesses in Ballarat Street and Reece Street asked their customers to be quiet because Mrs. Eichhardt was dying. Even the Presbyterians and Methodists said prayers for her to get better, even though she was a staunch Catholic. And the city council and the Masons didn't hold any meetings while she was dying. So the town came together and honoured her. It was a really lovely story.
I understand that, in fact, there were hundreds at her funeral.
There were said to be 400 people at the funeral, and the Lake Wakatipu Times said that every single person there owed a secret debt to Mrs. Eichhardt. She was known to be a really generous patron and very kind to the poor.
Central Otago author Lauren Roche was speaking to Bill Southworth about her novel based on the life of hotelier Julia Eichhardt. Next month is the Southern Heritage Trust's festival, which will run from the first of the month right up until the end of October. A central theme this year will be the great exhibitions run in Dunedin in the 19th and 20th centuries, especially the New Zealand and South Seas exhibition of 1925-26. The South Seas exhibition showcased Dunedin's strengths to the rest of the country and New Zealand's achievements to the world. That exhibition remains a truly remarkable example of civil engineering and event planning, with its sprawl of purpose-built structures and well over 3 million visits in around 6 months. We feel this is a great opportunity to reflect on what Dunedin was capable of in the past and what it might achieve now and into the future. The festival program includes 50 to 60 items, including talks, building tours, performances, kids' activities, film sessions, and more. Amongst the highlights this year are the return of the highly popular Gasworks Market, a lively program of short talks in Pechacucha style in our iconic railway station, a pop-up museum featuring items from local private collections, including 200 items from the 1925 exhibition, a family-oriented kite day on Quarantine Island, and a program of historic home tours in association with Cargill's Castle Trust. The Southern Heritage Trust is aiming to establish the festival on the events calendar as a significant annual event, as we feel that heritage is integral to Dunedin's identity as a city, and a major point of difference with many other similar-sized New Zealand cities. Gregor Campbell has never seen a tombstone that he could pass by. One in Dunedin's Northern Cemetery yielded up to him the heroic story of a rescue effort by a 1900 gold miner.
Dunedin's Northern Cemetery contains nearly 17,000 memorials and hundreds of unmarked graves. Some graves have stones which name some, but not all of those buried beside them. One of these is the grave of Alfred Lawrence de Rea. In December 1900, de Rea was a gold miner and rescue of a fellow miner, as reported by the Southland Times. Overcome by foul air. On Friday afternoon, two men had an experience which is quite unique in the history of mining in Orapuki. Two miners named de Rea and Buchanan were sinking a shaft at a place called Potts Gorge, and had reached the depth of 30 feet. They then procured an auger to bore for the wash, but before doing so they invited Mr. J. Forbes, who has considerable mining experience, to go down the shaft and give his opinion as to the formation. He consented to do so, but on reaching the bottom called out, "Pull me up!" He had been overcome with foul air. De Rea was then lowered with a spare rope, which was fortunately available, but he also had just time to call out, "Pull me up!" When he was got up, he was unconscious and bleeding at the nose and mouth, but soon recovered. Forbes was then brought up and found to be quite unconscious and frothing at the mouth. He was carried home under the care of Dr. Stockwell, who was soon on the scene. At latest hearing, he was just able to speak, but is very ill and is breathing very much impaired. It will be some time before he is himself again. A very simple precaution should at all times be taken in cases where foul air is suspected, and that is to lower a candle, and if it won't burn, then the place is not safe for life. 3 years later, Alfred died as a result of what he had done in the mine. The Waikato Argus had this to say about his death. "To the role of unsung heroes who lay down their lives for others must be added the name of Alfred Lawrence de Rea, who died in the Dunedin Hospital recently. About a year ago, at Orapuki, a miner named John Forbes lay unconscious in a shaft impregnated with fire damp. His comrade, with magnificent self-forgetfulness, went down the shaft and rescued Forbes from certain death. The rescued man recovered, but the rescuer has spent the greater part of his time since in hospital at Naseby and Dunedin. He finally succumbed recently to the last of a series of hemorrhages. The pathos of the incident lies in the bald newspaper announcement. On the 10th September, at Dunedin Hospital, Alfred Lawrence de Rea, aged 32 years. Home papers, please copy." The last sentence indicates that even his birthplace is unknown and, unless by chance, his mother may not know how bravely her son died. Surely there should be posthumous honour for such deeds. It is possible that Alfred de Rea's unusual name, coupled with that last sentence, led the Argus to assume that he was one of the many lone miners with family back in Europe. In this, they were mistaken. Alfred had a wife and family in Invercargill when he died. And I'm the very much alive and breathing Gregor Campbell for Heritage Matters.
Heritage New Zealand runs the National Historic Landmarks Program, and it's now set its sights on Oamaru. This report from Alison Breeze.
The National Historic Landmarks Program was introduced under the Heritage New Zealand Pohiri Tonga Act 2014. Its purpose is to recognise and protect the most exceptional heritage places in Aotearoa, those that tell foundational stories about who we are as a nation. These landmarks aren't just old buildings or scenic spots. They're places of outstanding historical, physical and cultural significance. Think of them as the cornerstones of our collective memory, sites that have shaped our past and continue to influence our present and future. How does a place become a landmark? To be considered for landmark status, a site must already be listed on the New Zealand Heritage List Rārangi Kōrero, which is the national record of our place-based heritage. From there, it must meet rigorous criteria: historical importance, architectural uniqueness, cultural relevance, especially to tangata whenua, and a robust risk management plan to ensure its long-term protection. So far, only a few places have received this prestigious status. The first was the Waitangi Treaty Grounds, the birthplace of modern New Zealand. This site holds immense significance as the location where the Treaty of Waitangi was signed in 1840. A few weeks ago, the National War Memorial in Wellington was added to the list. It stands as a solemn tribute to those who served and sacrificed in global conflicts, and it's now recognised not just for its commemorative role, but for its architectural and cultural value as well. Other proposed landmarks include the Oamaru Historic Town Centre and Port, known for its Victorian architecture and maritime history, and Te Matatiki Te Ora, the Art Centre in Christchurch, a hub of creativity and resilience following the Canterbury earthquakes. But why does this matter? Well, these landmarks are more than just places. They're living stories. They connect us to our ancestors, our struggles, our triumphs. They're places where history isn't just remembered, it's felt. Oamaru Historic Town and Port. This proposal is a unique one, as unlike the others that were nominated, this is a grouping of buildings and structures, 29 to be exact. The Otago Southland Heritage New Zealand office has been working on this proposal for several years. As part of the process, we have to make sure we have all the owners and registered interest on board, as well as local iwi and councils. The proposal has received strong backing from the Waitaki District Council, which approved the inclusion of council-owned assets, and Oamaru Whitestone Civic Trust, who has spent nearly 40 years restoring and maintaining key heritage buildings. Mayor Gary Kircher expressed pride in potentially hosting the first South Island National Historic Landmark. Morariki Runanga has supported the process with the desire to have their story of alienation and exclusion from the land to be told. The place holds significant cultural value for Mana Whenua due to its location within an extensive network of settlements and Kainga Hingakai cultivations and food gathering sites situated along the coastland and their inland waterways such as creeks, rivers and lagoons. Despite evidence of Maori engagement with the colonial economy and their presence in their colonial town and port as economic agents into the 1850s, Oamaru Historic Town Centre and Port provides a picturesque and homogenous experience of a Victorian township and port. Testament to rapid growth and innovation of 19th century settlers, the architecture is outstanding. It is the only example of intact Victorian limestone industrial buildings and port in the country, and is a reminder of the resourcefulness and drive of settler agriculturalists, industrialists and business owners who built this place. This place is the greatest cluster of the work of Thomas Forrester, an influential architect and secretary to the Oamaru Harbour Board. His influence extended not only to the stunning buildings, but also to the development of the harbour. In the 1980s, dedicated locals planned revitalisation and adaptive reuse projects that preserved the integrity of these buildings and their setting. Oamaru Historic Town Centre and Port is internationally celebrated as a unique and aesthetically compelling heritage destination. It provides a genuine sense of place where it's possible to step into New Zealand's most complete streetscape of Victorian commercial buildings. Just as Oamaruvians were motivated in the 1980s to conserve, restore and reuse their historic buildings, the place continues to have local, national and international relevance as a draw card for economic development through tourism, festivals and as a world-renowned film location. Public submissions for the NHL, or National Historic Landmark, will be opening very shortly, where you can have your say on Oamaru as a National Historic Landmark, so look out for lots of media around this. And this story is brought to you by Alison Breeze, reporting for Heritage Matters.
This show will be replayed on Thursday the 18th of September at 1pm and Sunday the 7th and 21st of September at 7pm.
As Aotearoa New Zealand's National Heritage Agency, Heritage New Zealand Poheretaonga is proud to sponsor Heritage Matters. Celebrate our heritage by becoming a member to visit more than 20 heritage places we care for across the motu for free. You'll receive a subscription to our award-winning magazine, exclusive member events, and free or discounted admission to over 1,000 international heritage places. Support the heritage of Aotearoa New Zealand. Check out visitheritage.co.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.